This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Episode 425. We're recording on January 14th, 2021. I haven't said the episode number in a while, so we kind of got the shock of the new
I had onto us lost there. Track of that.
Yeah, I think we're officially out of the... It's the new year. We're a fortnight from the new year. We've had, you know, multiple earth-shaking political events. So we kind of shook off the new year,
Feels a lot like the old year, personally.
I was talking to my brother last night, and I told him, it feels like the first 2 weeks of 2021 are just like an end credit sequence to 2020, the movie of 2020. Like the stinger where you find out Thanos is coming. Kind of what 2021 has been like.
I think we had both joked, and I've just seen it in the water, you know, on social media, people saying it won't really feel like a new year until after the inauguration. And now I am in the place, I guess, sadly for my soul, of maybe by the summer solstice, it'll feel like we're doing a different thing than we've been doing.
Yeah, I think it might be the Paris Olympics in 2024. That's the new year. It's kind of what I'm thinking.
Oh, boy. I'm not prepared to onboard that just yet. Yeah. 2024. Feels like it's a million years away right now.
Yeah. Well, and I tell you what, the even more highly charged political environment than it was is now infecting, influencing the world of books and reading. So we've got stories that cross over with what we talk about here, but we'll get to some of that in a minute. Let's take our first sponsor break first, though, before we do it. We're going to do follow-up. I've got a little follow-up. I don't think I put this on here from a couple of a listener email kinds of things. Mm. It's been a while, but I mentioned sometime in the fall about Amazon pricing for hardcovers. The discounting seems to have taken on a sea change. And then in the holiday season, it seemed to go back to a more consistent discounting level. And last week I saw for the first time in my memory, new front list titles from major publishers with zero discounts. Not even the 10% stuff we had talked that raised my eyebrows in the fall, but straight up nada. Now again, if you're a Reese's Book Club pick, if you're something that made a list, if you're Promised Land, the AAA things in the atmosphere aren't, you know, they're getting discounted 30, 40% if more. The next level is getting discounted 20, 25%, 15%. But then there's, as we know, most books, and they don't represent most sales, but most books are way below that level. And that way below are getting, you know, Simon & Schuster thrillers with $0 off from Amazon feels like, to me, a new thing under the sun. And a couple of people emailed the podcast this week saying, just following up on your discussion before, I'm seeing weird stuff in pricing where you're not seeing discounts like that. And this was, I think... some knitting book someone mentioned cookbook, someone mentioned some YA. There's a big YA title that we had a sponsor on the site last week with no discount, which is very, very unusual. So I'm not sure I have any new bad ideas to float as relates to that. The only thing, you know, just to recap on my bad ideas, one is for whatever reason, they don't want you to buy the ebook or the physical book from them because of, you know, fulfillment problems or COVID or mail or whatever. They just don't, there's like this, all right, fine. If you're going to buy this, we're going to charge you through the nose, which means just straight retail price. Second one is it strategic is if you're looking at a $28.99, I forget how much hardbacks actually are. $28.99 for this frontlist hardcover. Wouldn't you rather get it for $12.99 in the Kindle or $14.95 as part of your Audible subscription? It starts to look a lot more attractive if there's not much of a discount there.
Yeah, I think there's either some choice architecture stuff like that happening, or as I'm pretty sure that what I posited when we talked about this in the summer or the fall is that Amazon has realized that with everything else people are coming to yep. rely on Amazon for during the pandemic, they don't have to discount
don't
your books.
Have to.
Because you're buying everything else, you might as well. It's easier just to buy that full price hardcover than to go seek it out somewhere else.
Or even to go enter in your credit card information at Bookshop or something, right? Even to go somewhere else, like the transactional friction is still pretty high. So that one I thought was interesting to see there as a follow-up kind of a piece as well. I'm not sure any of these other ones, I guess. Nothing else is really follow up. So the book that I had mentioned was Money by Jacob Goldstein is the one that got me like, huh. And at the time it was a 10% discount. Right now it's a 20% discount. So it's come, it's still not, frankly, again, I'm not sure this is fair, but in the old days, any new hardcover you're seeing on Amazon was like 30 or 40%. That was just standard operating procedure. We're no longer in that world. Is that good for books? Is it good for books and reading? Are you super thrilled? I don't know, but boy, it's really, it's noticeable, right? It's noticeable. This other book I was looking at while we're doing this, why not? have you heard of this book, Pappyland, The Story of a Family Fine Bourbon and the Things That Last Forever about the bourbon?
Pappy Van Winkle?
Pappy Van
Indeed
Winkle.
Indeed, I have, yes.
You know the book? You've heard of the book?
I've heard of the book, yes.
Yeah, so I was looking at maybe listening to it or buying it. The hardcover full street price, $27. The Amazon discount right now is only 13%. And this is not, I mean, it's not, you know, New York Times bestseller, but there's 885 rankings, number one bestseller in a culinary memoir and biography, kind of a subset, but it sounds like there are some books being moved here. In olden times, I would have expected more of a discount for that book. I just would have. So anyway, as you're out there buying books, seeing stuff, what's going on, let us know what you're seeing, because you will find things that are more interesting, or you're just going to be looking at different things than we do. The cookbook one really got my attention, because cookbooks are expensive. And in looking around, it looked to me you're still seeing more of a discount for this. I was looking at Jubilee. Now, this is an older title. It's November 5th. 2019, Jubilee Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking that I was looking at maybe buying, and it's a 32% discount, 35 to 23. I don't follow the new hotness in cookbooks, so I didn't even really know what to search for in terms of seeing what the new things were.
I just looked, like, as you were mentioning it, because my favorite pie cookbook, The Book on Pie by Erin Jean McDowell, just came out in November, and she has done a ton. She's very well known in online content from New York Times stuff and King Arthur Baking and I think some other things. So its list price is $35, but Amazon has it for $25.17, which is a 28% discount. But I wish that I had looked at that, like, the 2 weeks before Christmas, because I would think a book like that is popular going into the holidays.
One book that I put on hold at my library after looking at the price, frankly, it's kind of a hot release, debut fiction, The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr., which came out last week. List price $27, only 11% discount. The full price on Audible, if you're not a subscriber, $25. $25 credit per credit. But
that's pretty spicy.
On Apple for the audiobook, $14.99. It's weird times. It's just all this stuff is changing. Hard to keep track of what to do. All right. So that's was other feedback I was gonna give. I guess that was it. That was the only one that was relevant to talk about on the show. News of the week. I guess the news this week that broke out. Outside of the world of books and just the world of books and reading, broke out into a popular story. It was on the front page of CNN briefly, that Josh Hawley's book that Simon & Schuster was going to release, they decided not to because of treason. Maybe, I guess, something like that, you know.
If ever there were a reason to finally decide you have some responsibility.
Yeah, and... Amanda and I were talking about some other stuff yesterday about how it looked like the left-wing internet finally caught up to our position, which is no, someone not wanting to publish your book is not a violation of the First Amendment, which all I can say is duh, but welcome to the
club.
Welcome. I'm not sure what else to say about it at this point. For the longtime listener of the show will know our position, which is you don't have a right to get your book published because no one does. Until the government says you cannot hand scrawl your ideas on a piece of paper and distribute it for free, you know, I'm being a little bit exaggerated, hyperbolic there, but not really.
Yeah,
you don't have a right for The First Amendment does not guarantee you the right with a publisher to enter into a private business agreement to disseminate mm-hmm. your ideas. But I think the Overton window for our acceptance of what a publisher and a bookstore, and we'll get to this in a minute, can and should be doing in the name of the body politic, the safe vouchsafing the Republic, apparently, this is the stakes we're talking about right now, has moved from you really have to be a real monster to get your book pulled to, boy, we really don't want to. Do you see what I'm getting at, Rebecca? Like, do we feel like the line has moved from people are more willing to entertain, we don't want to do this right now.
I think that this action by Simon and Schuster goes hand in hand with Twitter and Facebook and, you know, Amazon Web Services and all of the other businesses last week that decided finally at the very last possible minute mm-hmm. to deplatform the president and to really start monitoring the kinds of speech and the damage that the kinds of speech they might allow on their platforms so that they I think there's a level of responsibility that is finally being acknowledged.
Right.
I think, and that, you know, in previous moments like this, when there have been calls for publishers to cancel books, they've said something like, it's our mission. This is a direct quote from the statement about Josh Hawley's book from Simon and Schuster. As a publisher, it will always be our mission to amplify a variety of voices and viewpoints. In the past, that sentence has been followed by, so we are continuing to publish this book.
Right.
This time around, it's followed by, at the same time, we take seriously our larger public responsibility as citizens, and we cannot support Senator Hawley after his role in what became a dangerous threat to our democracy and freedom. Mm. I am very happy to see that. I think the next step that I want to see is not just we take responsibility as citizens, but we take responsibility as a powerful platform that decides whose voice is heard. You know, like, it's very possible that Simon and Schuster made this decision because of, I don't know. So they could have made this decision because of dissent within the ranks for the same reason that they decided not to publish Milo Yiannopoulos's book. Mm-hmm. Was it Simon and Schuster that was also going to carry the Woody Allen memoir?
That was Hachette.
That was Hachette. Okay. Yeah. This could be we have responsibility as citizens. You certainly have a responsibility as a platform. It seems similar in kind to me to Facebook being like, oh, right, yes, we do have responsibility here. We're not just a neutral space where anyone can say anything and we don't have to touch it or take any responsibility for it. There are consequences to allowing that kind of thing to happen. And like, just interestingly, in the case of Facebook, I was reading a story where they said that their internal research shows that a really high percentage of people who joined like right-wing extremist groups did it after being recommended to those groups by the platform.
So, unbelievable. Like,
right? The algorithms that you create have consequences and you are responsible for those. And if you publish books by people who support taking down our government from the inside, you have a responsibility for those. You're on the hook for what some of those consequences are. So part of me is like, I don't care why Simon and Schuster came to this conclusion. I'm just glad that they did. But I ultimately want to see more publishers getting to the place of like, this isn't just about us as a company that's made up of individual citizens. It's about what we are functionally doing by providing a platform to someone or not. But mm-hmm. really glad to see this. And I hope that it establishes precedent. I also hope that they are rewarded for it culturally and financially in a way that makes this a good business decision for them.
Yeah, the marketplace of ideas, people tend to forget the marketplace part of that, right? Mm-hmm. There's a marketplace of ideas situation that goes on here, and it goes all the way from, you know, the dudes that would hang out in the on the corner downtown in the town I grew up, handing out leaflets about legalizing hemp, which in 1991 seemed like a fever dream of a thing to happen, yet here we are. But they could do it. They could hand out their little leaflets. And, you know, that did not mean that Simon & Schuster needed to give them a book contract to do so. I do think that we've seen that the amplification of messages has really been a stress test on what do we mean by free speech? Like, what do we actually mean by that? And I think that reckoning has a long time coming. And disinformation, which is a euphemism for lying, I guess. Lying at scale is what we're really talking about. Purposefully lying at scale, knowing that you're lying at scale, presents problems we have not had to contend with when it comes to First Amendment issues. And I thought I'd have been the first to be like, Jack Dorsey, what are you doing? But in explaining Twitter's decision to pull Donald Trump's privileges, tweeting privileges, I thought it was very thoughtful, because he's like,
yeah,
we don't really want to do this, but we kind of have to. Not that they want to support Trump, but like, we recognize that this is a dangerous precedent for a platform that's now powerful to say this kind of speech is not allowed. If you're sort of evacuating it of the actual content, then it's really a question of getting into the content. Like, where are the lines that you can't cross and be a part of the idea society? Like, if you think of like Twitter, and we call these social media, but they're actually communities, right? They're these communities online, and we have rules that govern communities, and we need rules that govern communities that are largely about speech, right? The interaction is speech, and we just haven't figured that out right yet. Well, I don't think.
I think, you know, we had a pretty decent handle on it before 2016. That, like, not a perfect one, but that I think we had a shared cultural understanding that giving someone access to a platform or agreeing to publish their book legitimizes what's the contents in some way, you know?
Well, Simon, I don't know. Do you think so? Like, 6 years ago, Twitter was like Nazis were saying people, you know, like, now they don't do that. Now you can't do that
I think this is the public's understanding. That if they're allowed to if someone is allowed to publish this book, it must be legitimate. And then you add on what's happened in our political discourse in the last 4 years, where people spouting evident lies have been entertained and legitimized because Republicans have not wanted to upset their base. Like, okay, well, they're upset because they think the election was stolen. So let's conduct shenanigans to make them feel better. Like, let's, you know, object to validating these votes, even though there's no evidence. And that's the extreme thing at the end of 4 years of tiny drips of like, oh, well, he said this thing that wasn't true, or this book came out with facts that were not actually facts and nothing was done about it, or these lies were allowed to spread on Twitter. Like, Twitter and Facebook came to the game, but they arrived very late of actually, you know, fact checking political information that has a direct impact on voters, and therefore, like, on what people believe is true, and therefore has a direct impact on our democracy. You know, like, it shouldn't be news making that Mitt Romney has to stand up and say, we have to tell people the truth. Like, we have to look at our voters and tell them the truth. This shouldn't be, it shouldn't have to be said at all, but it's like earth shattering.
Yeah. It's striking to me that, you know, at one point in the food industry, we did not have the FDA saying, you know what, by the way, we need some regulation around factories. You know, we need some regulation about working conditions. We need some regulation around health and safety. It comes at scale. Scale is the thing that introduces the need for regulation, right? Because if Twitter or Facebook, whoever, is going to make billions of dollars letting people say stuff, they need guidelines for what health looks like of the republic, of society, realize what is good for people. And the day now is past where you can say, we're just a platform. You are responsible for the things people say on your platform. And you have to decide whether or not you're in the business of letting people knowingly lie and knowingly damage the very underpinnings of the society that makes your platform possible writ large. How much do you want to be in that game, Simon & Schuster or Facebook, whoever else it was going
to
be?
Yeah, if you're trying to, if you want to call yourself a space in which important conversations take place and where, like, cultural debate happens, then there does need to be some framework around what is actual cultural debate on all sides. The thing that's going, like, no one wants to suppress those kinds of discussions. We're trying to have all of the discussions from a place where people can return to having a shared set of facts. Mm. And the publishing of books that are not true, the allowing people, like allowing powerful people with large audiences to spout misinformation without any sort of consequence or regulation doesn't contribute to that.
Yeah. And again, these are not easy. I'm not saying that it's easy to do, because essentially what you're suggesting, we're suggesting, what some are suggesting, mm-hmm. the role of major platforms is to do is decide what is true enough to be, you know, in the forum, to be in the Agora, mm-hmm. to be a subject of public debate, and what isn't. And that's not an easy position to be in. But guess what? You have millions of users. You have a lot of hard things to do. That is the cost of the game you've entered into
play. Yeah, you know, if you want to make the Jack Dorsey money, you have to make those big boy decisions.
That's right.
That's
and
the cost.
You have to be able to pay the cost and decide whether or not your business is good for the body politic or society at large, or how to make it good. And it's not a surprise that these new technologies have brought about a new set of ethical and civil questions. But what we've learned is that not answering them is no longer tenable. To throw up your hands and say, you know, it's free speech, people can say what they want, that's no longer tenable. Just like ethically, it's not the thing, like we've talked about before, Popper's paradox, the only thing you can't tolerate is intolerance. Well, maybe we should add the other thing you can't intolerate is willful misinformation, willful poisoning of the waters about truth.
It goes back years to the introduction of the phrase alternative facts.
Right.
Like, we should have been having this conversation at that point. Like, you have freedom of speech. You have a First Amendment right. You don't have a right on a private platform to widely disseminate mm-hmm. alternative facts mm-hmm. and state them as true and then use them as justification for decisions that directly impact millions of American citizens.
Yeah. Yeah. And if your business is what people can is people saying things, and that applies from publishing to Twitter. If your business is people saying things, your central problem is where's the line of what they can say on this thing? That's your central problem. That is your central problem.
Like, not for nothing. We have to make these decisions at Book Riot.
That's right.
Book Riot is a platform. And we have to decide what's acceptable to us, mm-hmm. what's a risk that we're willing to take, what is a risk that we are not willing to take, what kind of speech are we willing to support and put out into the world. And there are plenty of people on other parts of the political spectrum who disagree with the ways that we run this company, who disagree with the kinds of content that Book Riot puts out. You know, we for TBR, for our tailored book recommendation service, all of the boxes are like mandated by me mm-hmm. to include books by marginalized voices, and that's included in the product description. And people sign up for the product and then get mad when we tell them, like, you cannot request to like never encounter a book by a gay person in your box. That's not what this product mm-hmm. is. This is my platform. This is your platform. We're allowed to make these decisions. And there are consequences there. Like, we choose to lose some customers. We choose to lose some readers. And you have to be willing to do that. And I'm just glad to see Simon & Schuster is willing to give up whatever money they would have made on Josh Hawley's book. And Twitter is finally willing to lose whatever users they have lost, or to lose whatever engagement metrics they have lost by deplatforming the president and removing QAnon accounts. It's not worth it. It is not worth it in the long run to let those kinds of things stand. The damage they do is not worth it.
Yeah. And over time, we've made a series of decisions toward the long arc of our decisions have been towards really only being accountable for the things people say for people who work for us, right? Because we used to have comments mm-hmm. on the site. We had other forums where people could discuss. And ultimately, we decided we were not comfortable. We did not feel like it was our business and is not something we wanted to do, nor could we do it well, to be in the business of deciding what people said on our platforms. Who we couldn't fire, essentially, right? I mean, we couldn't really have a discussion with them and decide that that was untenable for us, even at our scale. But again, that's not mm-hmm. our business. Our business is to pay people or, you know, host things for people to talk about books. Twitter's business, Facebook's business, YouTube's business is to get anyone who's out there to say stuff so that more people will read it so they can sell advertising against it. If that is your business model, and it's been a long time coming, deciding where the line is has been super important, and the line has been too low for too long. I think that's essentially mm-hmm. the thing. The line has been too low for too long And the people at the top of those organizations have not felt the pain enough. And now they do, I guess.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, they're probably very scared about the liability they might be found to have for having hosted the conversations in which this insurrection was planned.
I mean, I don't think it's too cynical to say these are the equivalent of deathbed confessionals, right? Only here at the end.
Yeah.
Right. Before it's too late. Are we trying to do something? The next one's a tricky, well, I don't know if it's trickier. It's a different wrinkle. So Powell's, the bookstore, the great independent bookstore here in Portland, Oregon, has entered into a different kind of controversy. They're not a publisher of book, but they are a stocker of books, S-T-O-C-K. They sell books. And there's a conservative pundit named Andy Ngo. I'm not sure how you say his last name, N-G-O. I looked around for it. I think it's Ngo or Ngo, or maybe just Ngo. He's a conservative, and he's a book out called, where is this book? I've lost the
Unmasked
title.
Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy.
There it is. Published by Hachette, coming February 21st. Not even out yet. And Powell's has been the subject, recipient, target, depending on how you're looking at it, of protests saying, we don't want you to sell this book. And Portland has had its own year. You know, everyone's had their own year. There is a very strong left-wing contingent here. There's even some on the left that does stuff that probably they shouldn't do. In fact, I know they shouldn't do when it comes to violence and vandalism. But others are saying, and some of those people are part of this, and some of them just on this, we don't want Powell's to sell this book. We don't want destroy democracy. It's hyperbole. I don't know what this book is. I don't know this person at all. But he did some doxing of people at Portland protests. So it's very personal here to Portland. But the larger question is, is the line being moved? The line of responsibility is coming down, it seems, or this is one of the first times we've seen the line coming down from whether a publisher should publish a book to should the store stock the book. And this is something I think you and I have sort of talked around from time to time, right? What the Trump books or the whatever coming out, what are bookstores doing about people want to buy something they maybe don't want to sell, but can they order it? And it's a whole mess, right? Because it's even further from we're publishing the book. It's can you even buy the book through us to, I guess not. Or we have to decide on a case-by-case basis what we're going to allow people to buy through our portals. And so Emily Powell, who is the CEO of Powell's, there was a press release that came to my email last night saying, we're not going to stock the book in the store, but you'll be able to buy it online. So there's not going to be physical copies, but if someone wants to get it, we're not going to prevent them from finding, you know, getting it online. We're not going to actively stock it. It just seems to me there's a fascinating array of choices. And where is the line of retreat? At what point do you say, you know what, we're out of this book? What point do we say, if this is a book that's out there, the bookstore is just a conduit? I find this to be a really fascinating question to me.
Yeah, I don't think this is actually like a new question for bookstores, because it is the same sort of thing that bookstores have been.
Yeah,
it's the same kind of decision that bookstores have been making about some of the Trump books, about some of the pro-Trump like propaganda books, for lack of a better term. And then before that, it's the kinds of decisions that they were making when Me Too was breaking in really big and consistent ways. And there were news about authors. So like, if you're a bookstore, do you take Juno Diaz off the shelves and off your website? Or do you just take him off the shelves? But if someone wants to order one, you'll order it. Like, there are those sort of same shades of decision here. Like the Powell's statement about why they've, I think there's a couple problems here, and it's a confusing message to say we won't carry it in the store, but we will sell it to you online. Like, that is just confusing. I find it to be
feels like a half measure, right? I almost it makes more sense to say we're going to keep we want to serve people who are interested in. If you think about serving customers rather than supporting the book, maybe you can make that argument. But I think time is... What were bookstores doing, right? We don't want to stock this book. We're not going to keep it on our shelves. But someone comes in the store and I'd like to order from you the John Bolton book. I'm just using an example, right? I want to order that from you. But they said, were they saying we're not going to order it from you? I don't know. What were people doing?
I don't know. Yeah. Booksellers, if you're willing to tell us, podcast@bookriot.com.
We'll keep you anonymous if you ask.
Yeah, yeah. The reasoning that Powell gives here, you know, we carry books that we find anywhere from simply distasteful or badly written to execrable, as well as those that we treasure. We believe it is the work of bookselling to do. Like, well, I would challenge that.
Isn't that Twitter saying whatever? I mean, it's sort of the same thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that's actually the work of bookselling. You can decide that's how you are doing bookselling, but it's not necessarily the only or the best way. And then there's this, I find to be very false equivalence, where the statement continues, decades ago, we received credible bomb threats for selling the work of Salman Rushdie, and yet we carried on. We cannot behave any differently today when we feel differently about the book or the writer in question. Actually, yes, you can.
Yes, you can.
If the behavior of the writer and the contents of the book are meaningfully different, you can make different decisions. And the objections that people had to Salman Rushdie and the danger that was attached to Salman Rushdie is of a very different kind than the danger presented here, especially in the environment, as you mentioned, that Portland has been experiencing this year with protests and
people getting swept into unmarked vans, Rebecca.
Right, and very violent acts committed against liberal protesters. This is a dangerous book to support. I'm actually kind of surprised that we're not seeing pressure on Hachette to cancel it at this point.
Probably, like, the profile isn't high enough. The profile in Portland is high enough, but nationally it's probably not high enough.
That if you're trying to serve your community and the thing that's happening in your community is people are piling up outside your doors with protest signs telling you that they don't want you to sell this book, you have to decide which customers you care about serving more. Yeah. That's the fundamental question. Do you care about those people in your community that are saying this poses a risk to us? Like, this person is promoting ideas that are dangerous and that incite violence. Mm-hmm. Or do you care about not upsetting the people who are going to call this censorship?
Yeah. And who is that exactly, right? Because presumably, like, there's books that they don't carry.
Yeah.
Self-published or indie press or whatever. So this position is like, by default, we can buy this online. I mean, sure, but is the software not sufficient enough for you to, like, kick an ISBN out of your ordering system? I don't know. I mean, do they have a technical
problem?
It
absolutely is. Yeah. You can absolutely exclude an ISBN from your ordering system. Right. I think in any of these moments where publishers say, this is just what we think the work of a publisher is, or this is just what we think the work of bookselling is, to put all of these things out there, that's a way to avoid having to make the hard choices. And the truth is, you have choices. You can choose to treat a Salman Rushdie book differently from a book by a guy who wants you to think that Antifa is out there and they're coming for you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe a more, I don't know if people would take this differently to say, you know what, this book is controversial. We do not believe the content of this book, but we think the discussion and getting it out there so people can talk about it and say that is part of what a bookstore does, right? We are not determining the marketplace of ideas. We are the marketplace, and things can get sold, right? Things can be excluded. Mm-hmm. You could say that. I'm not sure I would try that, but this, you can buy it, but we're not going to stock it. Feels like you're pleasing nobody and really not taking much of a... It feels like less principled than they think it is to say we can buy it online, but you can't buy it in the store. I'm not sure that helps anybody at all.
I think that what we've seen in this last week is that the idea that you're taking a principled stand when you sell or publish anything is, like, just by doing it, we're living into our principles, is no longer the standard.
Right. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I can appreciate the situation because it does open up a can of worms, which is already open, we just didn't think about it, of having, you're tacitly making the claim that we will be every single, and again, Powell's is millions of, I don't even know how many titles are in there. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you're helping, maybe what you should say is, like, we want the community to help us decide what's our community of book buying looks like. We can't do it all ourselves. It's unreasonable even for someone like Powell's to say, we're behind every single book on the shelves. But they can be open to, you know what, if this is not something we want in our community of ideas, let's get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, like, not to cast far too far forward, but I don't think it's unreasonable to think that some of these guys that have been arrested in the last week for participating in or leading the insurrection are going to try to get book deals. Some of them will probably be successful. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do with that?
Yeah. And I'm sympathetic to the scale of the problem, because books have, we don't think of tweets like we think about books. Like, there's no like romance of tweets, but they're functionally the same thing. A tweet is a book. When we talk about these kinds of issues, it's all speech, right? It's all speech. And how much are you going to put your skin in the game about which ideas, about which kinds of speech? You wouldn't require Powell's to pin up tweets by Nazis on their door, right? Does Powell's feel required to do that? They don't.
Right.
So
I was
how
gonna
is
say,
it that different ultimately?
Right. If this were a book by a Holocaust denier.
Yeah.
And people were protesting it, would Powell's have a different response?
That would be a good question. If not this, what? If not this, what is outside the pale of what you want to put your, you know, imprimatur on, even if it's the very, very lightest embossing of that imprimatur of all time, but still saying it's something that we will be a conduit to sail from. Presumably, if you order it through Powell's, they will still take their $12 margin.
Yeah.
It's naughty times, Rebecca Shinsky, naughty times. Let's take a sponsor break.
Very tingly.
And we'll come back. Okay. News. Do you care about MTV books coming back? I do not.
I do from a nostalgia perspective.
Right.
Like, I, you know, remember being deeply attached to my paperback of The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And I think it's interesting that such a small imprint that was such a product of a very particular like moment in pop culture had a book like that that became such a touchstone. I don't know what MTV Books is going to look like now, because I don't know that there's really like a culture around MTV.
I was going to say, I was a little surprised that MTV still existed. I guess I would have assumed, but this feels to me like let's get two old and musty things together and make it new. Because books, I mean, we love books. You know we do. But you're not like, oh yeah, if we just get MTV and books together, we got a hot ticket here.
Yeah, I don't have any idea like what to expect from this. Because I don't know what MTV is anymore, what it stands for. Do the kids care about MTV? Or like, is MTV Books getting rebooted and they're targeting us? Like, is this now for old millennials and Generation X people who remember MTV having been about something? Like, yeah, I'm going to be, I guess, passively curious about what the list looks like when they get going.
It says virtually nothing about what's going to be. So Christian Trimmer is going to be the head of this. It's going to be Russian nesting dolled over at Simon & Schuster, some sort of joint venture. I'm not sure how these things work. They work in a whole variety of ways. He was the editorial director at Macmillan's Henry Holt Books for Young Readers. And prior to that, executive editor at Simon & Schuster. So it sounds like a passion project of some kind, but is it going to be young adult? Is it going to be teens, college, new adult, fiction, nonfiction? Kelly Jensen, who we work with, reminded us, but brought up that MTV Books' signal contribution to the world of books and reading was being the publisher of Perks of Being a Wallflower back in the day. And The Rose That Grew from Concrete back in the day. That's Tupac Shakur's memoir. Or I guess that's was poetry? I can't remember now at this point.
Yeah, I think that was poetry.
Poetry, I think. But what is not getting published that MTV Books can publish, or who will buy a book that could get published otherwise that's best suited for MTV Books? I am not very, very sure. What a world in which, again, if we were doing annotated, we have a bucket for annotated ideas, rest in peace. MTV Books publication of Perks of Being Wallflower would be a good 15-minute annotate. Like, how did that happen? What was going on? Like, very, very fascinating to see what was going on at the same time. I don't know. Maybe.
Is it just going to be a bunch of, like, Jersey Shore memoirs?
The Challenge? 10 steps to surviving the challenge. Lessons Maybe. From the road rules. I don't know. None of those seems.
Are those even still things anymore? Yeah. This is how disconnected we are.
So my follow-up question to you is, what media entity that doesn't have a publishing imprint should?
Oh.
Any ideas?
That's an interesting question. What media entity?
Again, I'm not talking about licensed stuff where you get the uh-huh. Marvel kids book thing. I'm talking about they're sourcing and producing and putting their stamp on new stuff.
Huh. I don't know.
I don't know either. I was hoping you have a better answer.
Nothing is bubbling up. Like, I'm sort of rifling through other TV things, but, you know, like all the folks on HGTV have books.
Yeah.
I don't think HGTV has an imprint, but like they easily could.
My default answer for all these sorts of things, we can test out here to see if there's anything to it. When in doubt, guess Apple. So if Apple had an imprint, because they're making TV shows and movies, right? They mm-hmm. do phones, and they have iTunes and podcasts, and they have a bookstore. If there was an Apple imprint, is that interesting at all? I don't know. They certainly have the distribution channels if they wanted to get into digital books or audiobooks or something like that.
It feels to me kind of similar to like Amazon having Kindle Originals or Audible Originals. Like, it makes sense that they would want to do it. I understand why if you were Apple, you would want to maybe have your own your own book publishing platform for your own original titles. But what would it do that's different from what other things do? Like, what would be the unifying feature of an Apple?
Yeah, I don't know.
Imprint book? I don't have any idea.
It's kind of like, what's the unifying feature of like Apple TV and movies? Like, nothing really. I guess it's high quality. Yeah, no, they spend a lot of money on it. I'm not sure.
But there's no thematic through line there.
It seems to me that the disruption of niche publishing is from below in the form of like influencers getting book deals, which they're doing all the time now, right? But there's a huge gap between an influencer getting a book deal and then like a TV station or a brand or something else getting.
Yeah, I could see like
something like that
in the heyday of like the Travel Channel when Bourdain, you know, at the height of Bourdain stuff, I could have seen a Travel Channel imprint. Mm-hmm. I think they probably could have gone some interesting places with that, but I don't think that's the thing anymore.
If I had an hour's worth of inside dope from the history of our modern history of books and reading, why Oprah never did her own imprint? She must have been pitched at it in the 90s.
She has an imprint at Flatiron.
I know she does now, but that was back in the heyday. I mean, when they really were cooking, right?
Oh, yeah.
I wonder why. Because the Flatiron one, I don't think does that matter? Does anyone's like, oh, it's the new Oprah book? The seal means more than the imprint, which is weird.
Maybe we were just not in the land of celebrity imprints yet.
Yeah. Someone, like, what was the first celebrity imprint? That's a good question. Do you know? Podcast@bookriot.com, if you know. Because editors got their own imprints. That's why you have the Knopfs of the world and, like, all that stuff. But, like, the first...
Reagan Arthur.
What was the first one that was, like, not a book person... to get an imprint, or not an editor, or like working in publishing to get an imprint. We had the Sarah Jessica Parkers, we had the Bourdains. I don't know. I'd be really fascinated to know. And we've asked this question before. Which of them were great successes? Don't know. Don't have a good answer to that. Where are we? I'm off looking at links. What's next on the agenda, Rebecca? Where do you want to go next? We only have a couple more things.
It looks like you want to brainstorm some things about our next Adaptation Nation episode.
Well, you have on here that Bridgerton books are getting that Netflix bump. No shock. So did The Queen's Gambit, right? Also got that Netflix bump, that streaming bump. And it got me thinking, we're due for another kind of roundup of adaptations. Not a full Book Nerd Movie Club treatment, because this is new stuff that we're kind of evaluating on its own. The Queen's Gambit we have in here. News of the World, which just came out. It's coming out tomorrow on demand and in theaters, which is the Tom Hanks joint based on the Paulette Giles book, which I thought was really good. The Good Lord Bird, which you liked, which I haven't seen, but I've read the book.
I've watched half of it. There are some hard to watch moments.
Oh, great. Perfect.
That make me hesitant to do a wide recommendation for
it. The Bridgerton thing, Firefly Lane by Kristen Hannah, you put on here. Shadow and Bone is coming out in April, which I'm very excited. I've always wanted to read that series.
Me too.
But it became one of those, it's now number 50 on my Netflix queue, which means I'm never going to get to it.
Same.
But I would like to have an excuse to do that. So why don't we do this? Why don't we have people give us their feedback? You're not going to vote. You're not going to. We'd like to hear what you have to say. But Rebecca, which of these are most interesting to you, what we have here? Which of these are you feel game to talk about and watch for the first time?
Well, especially if we're just like watching one episode of each and talking about it. I'm game for Bridgerton. It's been a while, but I've read several of those novels, and I'm curious about what a Shonda Rhimes, more diverse take on it looks like. I've also been studiously avoiding coverage of it because if I watch it, I want to be surprised. So I'm unspoiled about what happens in Bridgerton. You know, it can't resist the Tom Hanks, and I feel like my soul might like that right now. And I have not read News of the World, so I'm open to that. I also haven't gotten to The Queen's Gambit yet.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've also never read a Kristen Hannah novel, and she's so consistently one of the best sellers of the year. On
her new book, I don't know if we talked about this earlier, 1.5 million print run for the new book.
I think from that angle, I'm really curious about what's the appeal. So Firefly Lane is, I think I would go read Firefly Lane before I watch the adaptation there. Yeah. I'm curious about that. Actually, I'm kind of open to all of these. Mm-hmm. Like, and I've never read Shadow and Bone, but it's also just sort of been on my forever someday maybe list. So that was unhelpful, but the answer is most of them.
Yeah, so I'll just tell you what I've seen The Queen's Gambit. I've been meaning to read the book, actually, because it's an interesting book, apparently. And the Walter Trevis, I believe, is the guy's name who wrote that book, also wrote The Hustler, like one of the great adapted novelists that no one knows.
I didn't know that.
I'm interested in Shadow and Bone, of course. I think some combination of News of the World, Good Lord Bird, and then things that are out, or rather, pick between Bridgerton and Queen. Does anyone care what we think? I mean, is it interesting? Or are these, well, do they care what we think is a bigger question. But of the people who care about what we think at all, writ large, is Queen's Gambit over? Is Bridgerton too big? Mm-hmm. Like, do we have any value add to those discussions?
Yeah,
I don't
that's
know.
Interesting.
I don't know.
I am curious about input on that. And I will say, I thought the first episode of Good Lord Bird was phenomenal and captures the tone of the book really well. So I'm down for that.
I'm not sure. I'm sure there's things that we're missing there as well. Emails, podcast@bookriot.com. Which of these discussions would you, an episode where we do three or four of these packed up into one, which are the ones you'd be most interested to hear or have a venue to listen to people talk about something? Shoot us an email. podcast@bookriot.com. I think we're done.
I think so too.
Yeah, done for the day. I think we are.
It's some heavy lifting here.
Yeah, I mean, by this time next week, hold tight to whatever is around. I should say what we're going to be recording. So the next one they're going to hear. Yeah. The next thing you're going to hear from us is our spring preview show.
Yeah.
Let's talk. I think we have one more sponsor. We're going to talk about our spring preview show here in just a minute. Let's do our last sponsor break and we'll talk about the ground rules for that. So we're going to do for our spring preview show a little bit different. We're going to mix it up. You know, we like to mix things up. Is I've compiled a list of 36 interesting candidates to talk about on the spring preview show. And I should say the spring preview, we're defining spring as ending on May 31st of this year. And that's when summer begins. So we'll have a summer preview coming up later. And we're going to do a draft. And our goal is for each, we're not going to know what the other one's picked. So it's going to be live to tape, this draft. And we're going to each get 10 selections. But we have not talked about and fleshed out in broad strokes. What are we drafting for, Rebecca? I've got a couple of ideas. I think we talked about before. Do you want me to pitch my ideas or do you have a sense of what you want to do first?
I want to hear your ideas. Let's do that.
Well, we thought about it like a fantasy draft kind of a situation where you try to win. The problem with that is how do you keep score after the fact?
Oh, do you mean because none of the records of which books sell and how many books they sell are complete?
Yeah, that's accessible? The truth. Or then we'd have to like intuit from the non-unit measures of the New York Times or book scans or award or whatever, or adaptation, we don't know. We had monkeyed around with a fantasy book league kind of thing before, but it's just the lead times are so long. You're not going to go if there's an adaptation to like 4 years yeah. later. So that was very difficult. So that one's hard. We could do book sales, right? Do they make it onto the books? You want books that make it onto the bestseller list. I think that's less interesting. My proposal is this. What we're drafting is a slate of books that would then become someone's spring reading curriculum, right?
I like it.
So mm-hmm. we're trying to pick the best, most interesting, most provocative, most diverse slate of 10 books that someone who likes books but doesn't follow this junk like we do would then get to, like, these are the books I'm reading this spring, and we want them to have the best experience they can have. And then what we'll do is we'll open it up to voting from our listeners, the emails. You can vote for my slate, or you can vote for Rebecca Slates as representing the best reading curriculum for someone's spring. Do you, any wrinkles, any thoughts, feedback on that right now, Rebecca?
I like that. I was also thinking we could do a follow-up episode in June where we look back, or like midsummer, I guess, if we have some May picks, where we look back at our respective picks and maybe analyze together which ones did well and which ones didn't, and gotcha. If anybody quote unquote won. So, but I like this how would you build a well-rounded slate of 10 books to
right.
read for spring.
Like, we're building a gift box of books for you to read this spring. Here it would here's what we would pick. I guess we could also do the after action report later too. It's like, of our picks,
yeah.
which one broke out. I should say, have you read any of these books on the list? We're not going to tip our hands. Oh. Have you read any of these ahead of time? Because I will have not, I don't think. So I'm
Let
picking pretty blind at this point, which is
list.
Part of the fun.
Yeah. I have read one.
Okay.
Oh, wait, I've read The Great Gatsby, but that's on the list because there's a new.
Yeah, we'll take that off. We'll take that off.
Okay, yeah, we can take that off. I have read one of these.
I think that's probably not enough to have too much insider information.
Probably not. I know if I don't know yet. I have to do my homework on all the rest of them, but I can imagine where I would slot this in my 10 book lineup mm-hmm. if I chose it, but I'm not sure if it's going to make the cut yet.
Also, to get super nerdy, are we doing a snake draft where it goes 1, 2, 3? You see what I'm getting at here? Where the number one pick gets the first pick and the second person gets picks 2 and 3? Probably not.
Oh,
have you ever heard of that?
I didn't even know.
Yeah, I think it's probably the difference. So this is what people do in some fantasy drafts, where the people at the player at the very top are way more valuable. Like, the number one pick may be 6 times as valuable as the number two pick, right? I don't have an obvious number one pick here, so I don't think we need to do a snake draft. We can just do back and forth.
Yeah, I don't know what the technical term for it is, but I do know there's a model of fantasy draft where, like, you get your pot of imaginary money.
The auction version, yes.
So I think we could have done an auction draft, and that would have been interesting. But I think we'll just take turns picking 10.
Right, yeah.
And being mad at each other for most of it, probably.
I think the other funny game would be to guess what the other person will pick. There's a little gamesmanship here.
Let's do that. Okay, so we should each also make our list. Like, we'll make our private list, and then we'll each guess about what 10 the other person is going to choose, and we can reveal those at the end.
Right. Let's see. I'm not sure. Okay, because I'm not picking for you now. We're picking for a generic book person.
Like, if we had to box these up and put them in the front window of your local bookstore as a grab box.
It reminds me, there's like that old, what was it, those picnic auctions where someone would put together a picnic basket and you'd bid on the picnic basket. So you're going to be bidding on our book baskets with your minds.
It's been a long week, and that struck me as really funny.
Because how else are you picking a basket with your pancreas?
With your minds. It was like, you know, just point your brain in our direction and we'll know what you're thinking.
Really, a box of books is a picnic basket for the mind, if you think about it.
Picnic basket for the mind is definitely the show title.
Here at the end, we came with the show title. And on that note, you can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com, especially for booksellers who have books that they've been weird about, you know, about selling, or maybe hard nose. are people out there telling people no if they come into a bookstore to pre-order something? I'm imagining some people are, and what they are and what the politics of that and the realities that would be look like. I know it's a difficult decision too.
Yeah.
Also, we'd like feedback about our Adaptation Nation picks. Probably there's something we've forgotten, because since everything's an adaptation now, I was texting with my friend Kamali today. He's like, did you ever watch the adaptation of Motherless Brooklyn? I'm like, geez, I forgot that existed. I was vaguely interested in that as well.
I heard Edward Norton on the Armchair Expert podcast talking about that, and I had the same moment of like, oh, I intended to watch that at some point.
Not a great, I'm guessing it didn't perform well. If you and I, who have read Motherless Brooklyn, and also like Ed Norton, I think we've talked about this before as a presence online, we still like, oh yeah, tough beat for Motherless Brooklyn adaptation.
That was a rough one. Yeah, let us know. Oh, Dune, but I'm not watching Dune.
It's not out yet. It's not out for a billion years. Season two of Dickinson just came out. Did you see that?
I'm going to be watching that, yeah.
Please don't vote for that, people, for me.
Well, we've already talked about it here, so we don't need to bring Dickinson into this, even though you're wrong about it.
The Devil All the Time came out, which was apparently bad. That was a Netflix version of that, though that... Anyway, we could do this all day, because everything's adapted. Talk to you later, Rebecca. Everyone, hang tough.
Have a good one.